and here's your host, Dr. Tony Bean.
All right, welcome back, everybody. Hannah's out today. She's got one of the wee ones, is feeling a bit under the weather. She should be back tomorrow. This is Tony Bean, Vice President for Student Life and Christian Worldview at North Greenville University. Christ makes the difference, and we are cultivating transformational leaders for the church and society. Okay, I get to say all that, and then I'm usually waiting on Hannah to say outspokenly opinionated and unashamedly something. Conservative. Yeah. I should know that by heart by now. But
informed and unafraid.
Yeah, that's it. I only partially listen to her. I'm usually looking at something else. Usually, it's celebrity birthdays, because that's what we do first coming out of the gate in the second hour. Ladies and gentlemen, if you're having a birthday today, we say this to you.
Happy birthday!
Yes! You're a celebrity on your birthday, and you share a celebrity birthday with these folks. Robert Wise was born in 1914. He was wise enough to win two Oscars for Best Director for Sound of Music and West Side Story. He was Best Director with both of those. Arnold Palmer was born in 1929. Roger Maris in 1934. Charles Kuralt, 1934. Jose Feliciano is 73 today. Bob Lanier is 70, member of the Basketball Hall of Fame, played for the Milwaukee Bucks and the Detroit Pistons. Let's see, who else you got? Charlie Waters, graduated from Clemson University, played with the Dallas Cowboys for a lot of years. He's 70 today. Amy Irving is 65, and Randy the Big Unit Johnson is 55 years old today. I miss him being out on the baseball, man, I got to tell you.
Mm-hmm.
I just remember, you remember that game where somebody rushed the mound? I can't remember. He brushed somebody back, and this guy rushes the mound, and Johnson just drops his glove and waits on him. And he gets out there, and Johnson just wraps his arms around him, sort of pounding on him. You know, was that Randy Johnson, or was that?
Sounds like Clemens.
Yeah, it might have been Clemens.
Sounds like Clemens.
Because I think Clemens did that Clemens one time. He wouldn't back down from
Clemens
a fight.
Was on stuff. We don't know.
Yeah. Oh, well.
Randy Johnson, you just hope he didn't hit you.
Yeah, that's right.
He was six, seven, or eight. And when he let go of the ball, I mean, he's halfway to the home plate when he's letting go, and it's flying in there.
Yeah, he's the big unit. I miss guys like that in baseball. A lot of fun to watch him play.
They used to have great nicknames.
Yeah.
Like who's on first, what's on second, yeah. I don't know, who's on third.
What's the name of the guy with the ball or whatever? All right. I wanted to talk a little bit about Christina Hoff Summers, and I didn't get a chance to look up her book title, but I'll have it for you before the end of the program today. But she was being interviewed by Ben Shapiro on Sunday Special, and I was listening to this, and I was fascinated by her terminology talking about the difference between equity feminism and gender feminism. And I really resonated with this, because when you look at what's going on in the culture today, it's the gender feminists that are dominating the debate. They're talking about, they actually believe that there's a sex gender system at work that is patriarchal, and that American women are an oppressed class who don't have opportunities in the workplace, and you've got the glass ceiling and the wage difference and all the wage gap and all these other things. When the truth is, if you look at what's going on in the United States, in the Western world, in fact, women have more opportunity and more equality than at any other time in history. And that is just an indisputable fact. And so what is this business about? She's asking the question, and she's a scholar, by the way. She's asking the question, what is this business about women who are oppressed and don't have equal pay and are not able to go into the workplace and get jobs that are available to men? There are actually a lot of areas in the American workforce where women there's not really any area that women haven't moved in some way or another and have become very prosperous. She talks about equity feminism, which was birthed out of what we would call classical liberalism, which simply called for women to have dignity, equality, liberty, and opportunity. Those four things. And women have achieved that. Her argument is that equity feminism has been just overwhelmingly successful in getting women into the marketplace and getting them very close to what she would say is parity when it comes to pay. Now, the gender feminists say that there's, as I said, there's this patriarchal society that is almost invisible. In fact, Catherine McKinnon, who is a very popular gender feminist author and actually sort of started the whole gender feminist movement, says that this patriarchal system is oppressive and that it functions at such a high level and so efficiently that it is virtually invisible. Now, that's a great position to have if you're trying to make an argument, because if you're dealing with something that's invisible, how do you argue against it? If you can convince people to embrace something that can't be proven or disproven. I mean, if you've got an invisible system, you can't point to facts against it. You can't really point to facts that support it. You just got a system out there that you've named, and whatever you say about it, people have to accept, and it can't be challenged. Because if you raise a challenge to this invisible system, then you automatically are part of the problem. And that's what's happened to Christina Hoff Sommers as a scholar. I mean, she's in the 1990s and early 2000s, people who were making the argument for equity feminism were actually winning the public debate. In other words, they were winning over the hearts and minds of the American people. But the problem was, while they were doing that, then the gender feminists were getting all the associate professor roles in academia. And so they've gotten in and gotten their tentacles deep in the education system, which is turning out more gender feminist as young people with skulls, as Rush Limbaugh says, skulls full of mush, go to college and get their thinking transformed by these gender feminists. They make the argument that all men are pigs and that men are going to oppress women and that it's natural for them to do so and that we have this victimization of women going on. And, you know, the victimization culture in America is prospering maybe more than anything else, because you've got, you know, if you're a minority, you're a victim. If you're a woman, you're a victim. If you're gay, you're a victim. If you're gender dysphoric, you're a victim. If you're whatever. I mean, you all you have to do in America to get ahead is not become someone who achieves something on your own merit. You just simply have to be one of those people who are being victimized, and then you can, you know, get into great wealth. Look at Colin Kaepernick. I mean, he's turned himself into a victim, and he's making a boatload of money off of Nike, because Nike likes to put victims on a pedestal to sell tennis shoes, which is really kind of funny, because all the things that Colin Kaepernick would decry, you know, racism, systemic, all these systemic things in our culture, he would argue stems from capitalism, and we need to just go ahead, as Jim Carrey is telling Democrats, to pull off the veil and be full-throated in favor of socialism. Well, Colin Kaepernick would say that as well. The problem is that he's out benefiting from his capitalistic ventures because he's turned himself into a victim, and it's actually making him a bunch of money, more money than he could make as a backup quarterback in the NFL. So, you know, I just find this interesting. You know, she was talking about this wage gap, which if you get into a debate with a gender feminist, they will automatically point to the wage gap. And they'll say that it's 20 cents an hour or some such thing. Well, it might be until you start looking at the mitigating factors. And there are a lot of them. For example, you have to take education level into account. You have to take what jobs we're talking about into account. For whatever reason, men tend to gravitate toward jobs that are extremely dangerous. She put this statistic out there, about 5,000 people killed in the workplace every year. And of those, about 94% of those are men. Well, why is that? Because men are willing to go and take those jobs. Those jobs pay more. Therefore, men have a higher income level. Men tend to go more than women into engineering. Men tend to go into metallurgy and into some of these exotic careers that pay a lot of money. Women don't tend to do that as much. Now, gender feminists would argue that this is part of the patriarchal, invisible patriarchal system that's turning them into victims. But that's ridiculous. It's just a natural tendency for men and women to choose careers on a different path. Here's another thing that's just absolutely true. When women begin to have children, they tend to work less. men, when they have children, tend to work more because there's still this idea. Now, the gender feminists would say, see, that's a patriarchal society. Well, it works pretty good for men to be making a living, bringing the income home to a wife who is raising children, and maybe she's working outside the home. But generally, if you're raising children as you're working, then you might not be making as much money as somebody who's totally focused on a career. And here's the before you start yelling, gender feminism and the patriarchal society, know this. Women, when they're surveyed, do this not because they're being forced to, but because they want to. They want to be home more with their children. There's a desire that I would argue, from the Christian worldview perspective, is a natural desire that God has placed a nurturing instinct into women that when children come on the scene, they want to turn toward that priority. And it takes a lot in society to try to turn women away from that. And that's what gender feminism does. It tries to undermine the role of women working in the home or raising a family. They say that that's part of the invisible patriarchal system that we've got to get rid of, that women have got to be charging into the workplace. Well, a lot of this is being debunked by facts and reason. And I would just, encourage you to go and listen to this podcast. It's a good one with Christina Hoff Summers. And if you get a chance, get a hold of her book when she talks about equity feminism. You know, she would be considered probably a classical liberal on a lot of issues. But when it comes to this, she is one of the leading voices against gender feminism, which is a political construct and is not based in fact or reality. 1-888-660-WLFJ, 888-660-9535. When we come back, we're going to talk about AI and what that means to YOU. 888-660-9535. Stay with us.
And here's your host, Dr. Tony Bean.
All right, welcome back to the program. Thanks for listening. Hannah's out today. She has a little one who is feeling under the weather. She should be back tomorrow. We look forward to that. So we're a soldier on here with Christian Worldview with Tony and Hannah, just with Tony. About a month ago, according to Jason Thacker, let me back up a little bit and just explain a little bit. When I was at the ERLC trustee meeting, I ran into this guy, met him. He's a writer, researcher, policy developer for the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention, works with Russell Moore. And he's written a piece here. He's written a lot. He's kind of made himself an expert on AI, which is artificial intelligence. And I asked before the break, why should AI matter to YOU? And the reason is because it can affect YOU. It can affect you in a very detrimental way as it relates to your human dignity and also to future job opportunities that you may or may not have. But Thacker asked the question, why artificial intelligence can be a threat to human dignity? I really believe that from a Christian worldview perspective, Christians are going to be dealing with this ethical question for years to come. One of the things that is absolutely mind-boggling to me is the proliferation of these robots that people are using for as sexual partners. I mean, this is... that they've become extremely lifelike. I mean, people are working every day to make these robots that are mostly men, because men are sight-driven when it comes to sexual desire, are choosing as a partner. I mean, they open the first, I can't remember what country it's in, maybe it's Sweden, but they open the first brothel that's purely populated by these lifelike sex bots, is what they're calling them. And I mean, the implications here, I mean, people are saying that this is not really sexual immorality because they're going with a artificial intelligence robot that's designed for sexual pleasure. And so where's the sin in all this? Well, how about lust? How about the fact that the Bible speaks very strongly against lust? God created sex to be between a man and a woman within the context of marriage. It's not for our entertainment. It's not for our purely our, you know, to stimulate our senses. It has a purpose. Reproduction is one of the purposes, and intimacy, emotional, physical intimacy between a husband and wife that bonds, helps to bind and bond the marriage together, two people for a lifetime. And when you take that and you put it outside the context of marriage, it becomes a destructive force. Within marriage, it's a beautiful thing. Outside of marriage, it's a destructive force that, I mean, you've got a hookup culture that is absolutely, you know, ignoring any kind of morality being attached to sexuality. I was listening to John Stone Street on a podcast here recently talking about that one of the gods of this age, and he ticked through five of them. He said sex, the gods of this age are sex, self, science, the state, and stuff. In other words, things that we want to accumulate. And when it comes to sexuality, we've become a society and a culture that defines itself by our sexuality, and it's leaving a lot of broken people in its wake. So, in any event, artificial intelligence is going to have an impact on that because of the sex bot industry that's rising up. That's just it makes me want to have to go take a shower after even telling you about it, say anything about it. But here's what got Jason thinking about this article. About a month ago, and this was written, let me look at the date here. I think it's recent. Yeah, it was written in June. About a month ago, Google announced a groundbreaking technology that it hopes will revolutionize the way humans interact with computers. Google Duplex was debuted at the Google I.O. Developer Conference on May the 8th in Mountain View, California. Now, Duplex is a piece of artificial intelligence, get this, that can make phone calls for you. And Google is planning to release this technology to the public later. In fact, it should be available to the public now. But here's what it does. It actually makes telephone calls that you can't determine is coming from a computer. If this piece of technology is in use and you get a telephone call, there's no way, they're saying, and Jason's tried this out, it's very, very difficult to discern that you're not talking to a human being, because the person or the machine on the other end of the phone is going to react with you in ways that a human would. And, you know, obviously this could, without a human supervisor, this could be a step forward in technology for people who are, you know, in the business of making phone calls for a living. But now that's going to eliminate jobs. Obviously, that's one of the challenges of AI, is the elimination of jobs. So at the core, Duplex is a piece of artificial intelligence that is based on something called RNN. Now, as we get into this is not the only time we're going to talk about artificial intelligence. This is going to be an ongoing conversation, because again, this is one of those things that's really going to become an issue in the church going forward. But RNN is recurrent neural network, where the system employs the newest type of machine learning that is able to understand what is being said, interact with the other caller in real time, pace itself, account for variables or misunderstandings, and then speak in a natural way that is virtually indistinguishable from another human in the context of a phone call. Now, how did they teach this system to do this? Well, the system was able to learn these methods of communications from a set of recorded calls given to it by the developers. It processed these calls, learned from them. We're talking about computer technology that's able to adapt and learn from things like listening to a telephone call. It processed them, learned from them, then it made practice phone calls with human supervision and was able to learn from its mistakes with a human supervisor. And soon after, these calls were being made with no human intervention whatsoever. Now, what is the fallout here? What is the threat? We would see that, and there's always been people who have, you know, as we've crossed barriers of technology, that there have been the naysayers who have said that there's a downside here. I mean, there were people who said, you know, there was a downside to the horseless carriage, to manned flight, to all of these things. Well, none of those things were a threat to human dignity. You know, the horseless carriage might have been a threat to horse dignity, but not to human dignity. That was a step forward for humanity. But Jason writes here that the tools that we have created are becoming smarter, faster, and more adept at interacting for us. This shift has the potential to improve our lives by allowing us to focus on more complex tasks, but I believe this shift is more dangerous than many think. The rise of AI-based technology like Google Duplex is one of the most subtle threats to human dignity to come in our lifetime. It feeds into the popular notion that our dignity and worth is solely dependent on our usefulness to society rather than having that dignity and worth bestowed by the living God. So go back to the abortion question. You know, why are abortionists and pro-abortionists willing, how is it that they're able to convince themselves that what they're doing is okay? Well, they look at what grows in the womb and they say that until it has usefulness and for society, it doesn't really qualify as human, so we can abort it. And on the other end of the spectrum, when people get old enough that their health issues make them no longer a benefit to society, then it would just be better if they would shuffle off to Buffalo, so to speak, and go ahead and shuffle off this mortal coil and move on to whatever's next. And of course, for progressives, that's just, you know, a hole in the ground. Just you become, you know, the fertilizer for the next generation of food, then, you know, that's all you're good for anymore. So your life has no meaning once it's past its usefulness for society. And artificial intelligence has the potential of making that a genuine threat. And there's this whole idea, too, of just plain old, you know, if you think you're concerned about fake news, what about fake phone calls? How are people going to react when they get a phone call and they think they're talking to a human being and it turns out they're interacting with a computer? What does that do for relationships? How does that affect the way that we interact socially? And what is it going to do for people when they're no longer having personal human interactions, but substituting interactions with these computers? That's kind of what's going on in the sex bot industry, where you have human beings that are finding a gratification that God intended to be part of a powerful bond between a man and a woman within the bonds of marriage. They're finding that gratification with a machine, and they're losing out on the other emotional benefits of having a relationship with another person on an intimate level. And so, you know, we're already losing jobs to automation. And it used to be that we would say, well, there's some jobs that AI systems can never replace because, you know, it requires social engagement and what Jason Thacker calls emotional intelligence. So those jobs were always going to be safe from just the rote, you know, jobs that a robot and what we typically think of a robot can perform. The truth is that now we have thinking machines that can emulate emotional intelligence and can function on that level, which can threaten jobs that require that as part of their, of their, you know, to be able to do the job. Let me just wrap this up here. Last paragraph that Jason writes. As Christians, we know that God defines our worth and dignity regardless of what we can do. In reality, we have nothing to offer God or others. You look at Isaiah 64, verses 5 through 7. Still, because of love, John 3:16, God chose to send his Son to earth to redeem us and give us everlasting life with him. And we must be the ones at the forefront of the movement proclaiming that true worth and dignity are not found in silicon chips or data sets, but in the heartbeat of those uniquely created in the likeness of our God. That's a powerful statement, and it's an important statement. All right, let's take a break. We'll come back. If you'd like to comment about this, I'd love to hear from you here on the Monday morning. 888-660-9535. That's 888-660-9535. Get you on Christian Worldview with Tony and Hannah.
And here's your host, Dr. Tony Bean.
All right, welcome back, everybody. Hannah's out today, but hopefully she'll be back tomorrow. She's taking care of one of her little ones who's a little under the weather today. All right. You know, everybody's talking about Supreme Court cases, and we should be, because they have a tremendous impact on our everyday life, from immigration policies to racial discrimination to LGBTQ supposed rights, executive power, you name it. But in September of 1958, according to Bill Mears of Fox News, he's got this piece today at Fox News if you want to go read it. It's a good one. He's talking about the day or the case that caused the United States Supreme Court to essentially declare itself as a co-equal branch of the federal government. Now, this was under no one less influential than Thurgood Marshall. Yeah, I mean, this is an amazing thing. Let me read some of this to you. I know I'm doing a lot of reading today, but this is a really good piece. Thurgood Marshall, the prominent lawyer for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, had sized up his audience when he was up for confirmation to the court. 9 older white men who were none too thrilled about revisiting their landmark precedent that was proving nearly impossible to fully enforce. So Marshall was essentially arguing that officials in Little Rock, Arkansas, had to follow a federal court order to desegregate its schools. The 50-year-old focus was not black students seeking equality, but about society's larger civic responsibilities. Quote, education is not the teaching of the 3 R's. Education is teaching of the overall citizenship, to learn to live together with fellow citizens, and above all, to learn to obey the law, he says. He says, I'm not worried about the Negro children at this stage. I don't believe they're in this case as such. Marshall went on, I worry about the white children in Little Rock who are told as young people that the way to get your rights is to violate the law and deify the lawful authorities. I'm worried about their future. I don't worry about the Negro kids' future. They've been struggling with democracy long enough. They know about it. Now, this is an audio of Thurgood Marshall, who was secretly recorded by the court and was made available to the public decades later. So what about this case that he was talking about? The court's ruling in Cooper versus Aaron came 4 years after Brown versus Board of Education, which found separate but equal public facilities unconstitutional. It was groundbreaking, but many civil rights activists believe little progress was made in the initial aftermath, which is a sentiment that was echoed today. Justice Breyer, in a speech this past January, said nothing happened in 1954 or 1955 or 1956. The Brown ruling simply declared school segregation policies violated the 14th Amendment. So what this eventually led to is the question of the power of the United States Supreme Court. Does the Supreme Court have the ability to force its citizens to respond and to act in a certain way? And this essentially is what the court said, and it's been backed up for years since the 1950s. And when the Supreme Court became the de facto third branch of government, then that's when you started seeing these hearings become in some ways contentious. And as the partisanship divide between left and right in this country grew over, say, particularly during the 80s with Reagan, you know, Ronald Reagan becoming a true conservative who won the presidency, as that divide began to widen with George H.W. Bush and then George W. Bush and Bill Clinton and right on down through the ranks, you began to see more acrimony when it came to these Supreme Court justices. And the reason is because the Supreme Court became the ultimate arbiter of right and wrong when it relates to the Constitution. That's an incredible amount of power. That is not what the founders intended. They never intended. In fact, the Supreme Court was sort of it was one of the branches of government, but it was subordinate to the legislature, to even to the executive branch. I mean, the Supreme Court started out in the basement of the United States Capitol, and not until the 1950s did it move out, get its own digs, and sort of establish itself as this ultimate arbiter of the law, which is really where we are today. And that kind of can all be traced back to 1958 and this decision in Cooper versus Aaron. So if you want to read more about this, I thought Bill Mears had a great point that we look at a lot of Supreme Court cases. I mean, we think about, cases like Plessy versus Ferguson. We think about cases like Roe versus Wade. We think about, the masterpiece Cake versus the Colorado Civil Rights Division. We think about the Supreme Court case that settled eminent domain, that gave same-sex marriage the right in this country. All of those are huge cases, but they revolve around the fact that the Supreme Court declared itself as the supreme arbiter. If that hadn't happened back in the 1950s, then we wouldn't have all these other cases having such impact on American society. 1-888-660-WLFJ, 888-660-9535. We'll be back in 3 minutes with our final segment on Christian Worldview with Tony and Hannah.
And here's your host, Dr. Tony Bean.
All right, what's up with China? Now, there's a lot of ways to talk about that topic. I mean, we could say, what's up with China and their military, because they're building up their military in a way that has the Pentagon's attention. We could say, what's up with China and trade, because obviously the Trump administration and the Chinese government is in a pretty good tiff over trades, where we're getting this tit for tat back and forth with, we're going to slap you with these tariffs and China's going to slap us with those tariffs. And there's a lot of slapping going on, and I don't know how much progress is being made. But anyway, we could say that. But when I ask the question, what's up with China, what I'm asking is what's happening with this current crackdown on Christianity. You know, this is growing in China. We've mentioned it sort of in micro in a few programs prior to this, but we need to start paying a lot of attention to what the Chinese government is doing to churches, because they're destroying crosses, they're burning Bibles, closing churches, and forcing Christian believers to sign papers renouncing their faith. I mean, there's an intense crackdown going on in China. The suppression of religious freedom is an official government campaign that is designed to censize religion by demanding loyalty to the Communist Party. I mean, this is old stuff that's being recycled into new stuff. This is what the Soviet Union did. They pick a form of religious behavior that they can sanction by the state, and anybody that falls outside of that model becomes an enemy of the state and is subject to having their churches bulldozed. I mean, they're bulldozing churches in China. And people will say, well, it's not that bad because China gives a lot of leeway, and it's just that these churches are rebellious and they won't get a license. What? I mean, doggone right they won't get a license. Since when do you need a license to be a church? From the state. I mean, in America, that's a pretty foreign concept so far. For the Chinese, they're putting it into practice. The international, this is according to Bob Few of China Age, says that the international community should be alarmed and outraged for the blatant violation of freedom of religion and belief that's taking place in China. The situation of Chinese hashtag Christians has become more dire by the day. We're working tirelessly to put maximum pressure on China to stop the persecution. That's Jay Sekulow, who's, of course, President Trump's attorney and chief counsel at the American Center for Law and Justice. Persecution of Christians in China is, of course, nothing new. Freedom House, which is a watchdog group, put out a report that Christians and other religious groups in China have been persecuted since 2012. The thing that makes this very concerning is that even after political pressure has been applied by the Trump administration, And this, these abuses are being brought to light in the international community. China isn't backing off. They're ramping up. They're not bulldozing fewer churches. They're bulldozing more. They're not throwing fewer Christians into jail. They're rounding up all they can find. The Chinese government is waging, at the moment, the most severe suppression of Christianity since religious freedoms were granted in the Chinese Constitution in 1982. And, you know, this is, you've got Xi Jinping, who just consolidated power. If you remember, Xi Jinping doesn't have to get elected anymore. He's the most powerful Chinese leader now since Mao Zedong, who was the notorious communist leader that was responsible for millions of deaths in China. At the same time that Stalin was wiping out much of Russia, at least the peasant population. So we've got film that activists have smuggled out of the country that show piles of burning Bibles, and the authorities allegedly force the believers to sign these signatories, these forms, or risk being expelled from school or even losing welfare benefits. A Christian pastor in the Henan city of Nanyang, whose name was not identified, out of fear of retaliation by the authorities, reportedly confirmed that crosses, Bibles, and furniture were being burned during a raid on his church on September 5th. So what the Chinese law says, like I said earlier, is that religious believers are allowed to worship only in government-sanctioned congregations. But millions, tens of millions, maybe hundreds of millions of Christians, because we don't know how many of these congregations exist. We know at least the last number that we had that was pretty solid was 50 million Christians, and that was 20 years ago. So there's no telling how many of these congregations are around now, but they're totally underground house churches that ignore government regulations. And I think that's what's got the Chinese government up in arms about all this. The anti-religion campaign affected not only Christian denominations, around 1 million adherents to another religion that I can't even pronounce, and other members of Muslim minority groups in the country's northwest have been detained in indoctrination camps where they're forced to denounce Islam and profess loyalty, not to Christianity, but to the Communist Party, which, again, points back to Xi Jinping consolidating power and becoming pretty much the president in perpetuity, which makes him a dictator, a tyrant. China has around 38 million Protestants, and some have predicted that the country will have the world's largest Christian population in a few decades. Folks, let me remind you of something. Tertullian was right. That martyrs are the seed of the church. The blood of the martyrs becomes the seed of the church. The church grows, flourishes, and thrives under persecution. We get fat and happy when we're the ruling class. And that's what's happened to Christianity in America. Christians have become just, you know, I think we take for granted sometimes our freedoms. And now that some of those freedoms are coming under attack here in this country, we're beginning to wake up to this fact. But yes, it's hard sometimes for Christians like the cake baker in Colorado. His name just escaped me, and I hate
Phillips.
Him. Jack Phillips. That when it's hard for us to see that and to think this is America. But, you know, his church is not being bulldozed. Bibles are not being burned in the parking lot. Not yet. That's happening in China. We need to pray for our Christian brothers and sisters that are in China that are undergoing this persecution. And we need to pray for religious liberty in this country, something that the much maligned by President Trump, Jeff Sessions, has done an amazing job in pushing. And of course, Sam Brownback, who is the ambassador for religious freedom that the Trump administration has established, has done an excellent job, and Vice President Pence has brought a lot of attention to the issue of religious freedom, not only here in the United States, but around the world. All right, that's all the time we got for today. Hope you've enjoyed Christian Worldview with Tony and Hannah. Don't forget, we'll be tracking the hurricane for you. We'll be talking about it tomorrow. Maybe Dale Gilbert will get the memo by tomorrow, and he'll be talking about it. But regardless, we'll talk about it. Hope you have a great day. God bless you. See you in the morning, 7 o'clock.
The opinions expressed on today's program are those of the announcers, their guests, and callers, and do not necessarily represent those of the staff and management of His Radio Network, the Radio Training Network, or iHeartMedia.